Hello again. This is Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. That's toll-free. Nationwide, it's our voicemail number. And it's time for another one of what we've been calling the gritty reboot series of the Ask an Atheist thing, where we talk about some subject matter that we covered very early in the show and haven't really touched since. This one's a little bit unique because I don't know that we've ever really talked about this as a focus on the air. It's just been, well, something that I talk about a bit in my life because of a certain collection not 3 feet from me. And that's my collection of fiction from various religions and propaganda and the like. And so we're talking about specifically Christian fiction this segment, specifically because of the person who I have in the room. And joining me today is Carol Brulette. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Very good. So if the name sounds familiar to you, if the voice sounds familiar to you, it should. If you listen to any of our commercials, she is one of the people who do the voiceover work on our commercials. So you probably hear her voice somewhat frequently.
Yeah, and you're going to get to the middle of this episode and be like, oh, let me fast forward. Must be an ad.
Wait, nope. Ha ha.
No. It's real. Keep listening.
And also, one of the hosts of a show produced in this very room, and that's Hands Free Football.
Yeah, we've got like 14 whole listeners now, and we're looking for more. We talk about soccer, and I know that, like, and I don't know. It's hard to grow listenership because everyone who's, oh, you're talking about soccer.
Yeah.
But that's exactly the people we're trying to talk to.
You named one of your early episodes the Team of Theseus.
Oh, yeah.
It's not your standard sports talk guy from New Jersey complaining about everything that isn't the Knicks kind of thing.
The one I'm editing right now, we spent probably a good 10 minutes talking about the awkward ethics of trying to have real human compassion for injured athletes, but then putting in the calculation about, like, man, really, San Jose has 5 guys out right now? I feel like our chances are a lot better. And so it's like, you feel like a terrible person for making that calculation, but it's just kind of part of being a sports fan, is apparently being a
Shazbot
human being. I don't know. Am I allowed to cuss on this show?
No, you're not.
Oh, crap.
That's okay. I'll edit it out. I've got a soundbite set aside already. I forget. You're on the air so much here that I forget that you have to be warned that this is, we have to keep it kind of clean on the language here.
Sorry about that.
That's okay. I think we flogged your show a bit.
Okay.
So let's talk about Christian fiction. And this goes right back to you, because you're unique in sort of the group of people who hang out here with Ask an Atheist, is in that you converted from being religious to not religious in the time that I've known you.
Yeah, and actually, it's funny. In the time that I've been in Tacoma, I've converted from being not religious to religious and then back again.
Okay, so can you give time frame that for me?
In 2001, I moved up to Tacoma to attend college, and the first group of people that I fell in with were Christians. It was the InterVarsity Christian Fellowship on campus, and they did their, like, love bomb thing real effectively. It's just, you know, everyone's got to find a community at college, and this is the one that found me, and, you know, found Jesus, and et cetera, et cetera. But this was all happening at the same time. So I'm getting my degree in English with an emphasis in creative writing, as I am finally, for the first time in my life, having someone explain Christianity to me.
Okay.
Because I grew up in a household of atheists, and my mom drug us to church, a Catholic church, until I was like 9, and I had no clue what was going on. I didn't get any of it. So it was like a religious education at the same time I was getting, like, you know, my solid literary education. And then, I don't know, sometime in the last 3 or 4 years, I finally hopped back over the fence from agnosticism, and it's like, man, the world might actually be better off without religion. I'm an atheist now.
Right.
So.
Yeah. It's actually kind of funny how we met, because it was your sister who was out of town who basically dragged you and Dave.
Yes.
To a post show.
I think we actually brought her because she was missing out on the Reason Rally, and it's like, oh man, we have to do something to make this worth her while.
Yeah, I saw you guys, and then I didn't see you guys for a while, and then suddenly you were around every weekend.
Yes.
And not too long after that, Dave was my head writer. So
funny how that happens.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess we need to talk about the differences, about what we're going to talk about here versus what we're not going to talk about here. Or I guess getting our categories straight.
Yes.
Which is the difference between Christian themes in fiction and Christian evangelical fiction. So why don't you give us an initial split between the two.
Okay. I would say it's very, very difficult to avoid having Christian themes in fiction in the Western world, simply because, man, it's all up in our culture.
It totally is.
It's really hard to do without it. And one of the things that I learned early on while I was getting, you know, the English degree was that basically all of Western literature, it's either Jesus or dicks.
Right.
So it's one of those. It's a Christ figure or a phallic symbol, and it's just prevalent.
Sometimes both.
Yes, in fact. And so that's Christian themes in literature, is you're trying to tell a story and you're going to do something about redemption or resurrection or martyrdom. And it's just because that's a story that our culture tells all the time anyway, and it's impossible to escape.
Right, right.
Evangelical Christian fiction is when you warp the story beyond quality so that you can tell people how to become a Christian, why you need to become a Christian, or how to, in some cases, how to be a better one. But it's like the story exists as a platform for that evangelical message.
Right. In a lot of fiction, the story, the narrative is the payload, if I'm going to make a phallic comparison to rockets here, where, you know, the whole point of the exercise, the whole structure that's being built is for the sake of a narrative or characterization in the context of a narrative. Where in evangelical fiction, and specifically Christian, the payload is actually Jesus.
Yes.
And that's what they're trying to get across. So everything, all of the construction, all of the buttressing is in support of something that is actually kind of external to the story. And what you're supposed to take away from it isn't how good the story was. It isn't enjoyment of the story. It's supposed to get you to buy their brand of toilet cleaner instead of have a good time.
Yeah, and I think that's why there's a significant difference in quality between literature that just contains Christian themes versus the evangelical literature, is because people who are going to write evangelical literature, either you're going to like warp the story so bad in order to fit it in, you've got like those four pages at the end where someone has to explain like how to accept Christ as your Lord and Savior, and it just, you know, put the story on pause and do that for a second and then maybe go back to the story. Or because, you know, maybe they're not a professional writer. Maybe they're not paying attention to other themes and artistic devices, because that's not the point.
Right.
Yes.
All right. So let's get, you've specified four major categories of Christian fiction. Not that these are the only categories, but these are four large.
Yeah, I don't think it's an exhaustive list.
No, but it's certainly enough for talking about on one segment of the show. And the first one, I think, is the part that hews most closely to the differences between evangelical fiction and fiction with Christian themes. And that's allegorical.
Yeah.
The allegorical story.
Yeah, and this might be sort of the straddle point, because if it's a good enough allegory, you might even not realize that it's Christian fiction.
Yeah.
I think the hallmark of this, like the big example, has got to be Narnia.
Narnia's got to be the biggest one, because Jesus Christ is a lion. Get in the car.
Yes.
Yeah. And Narnia is also interesting in that I didn't know about Narnia at all until I was in my 20s. It was not something that was in my household. And basically, when people started talking about turning it into a movie, they go, oh, damn, they're turning Narnia into a movie. And I'm like, that's great. What is it?
Yeah, and I mean, I grew up reading Narnia, but again, I grew up in a largely non-religious household, and so when I got to college, and it's like, oh my gosh, Aslan is Jesus? What? Like, it was a revelation, and of course, you know, budding English major, here I am going to read through, and it's like, oh my god, it makes sense, and the stone table, and the Old Testament, it was actually kind of a fun moment, but I mean, I read through that whole series probably like 5 or 6 times as a kid, and I never would have picked up that it was religious in nature.
Well, what I liked about C.S. Lewis is that he did seem to have a Christian concept as an author and as possibly an early author of science fiction, even if that's not what he would call it. A concept of Christianity that extended merely beyond the Old Testament and Earth.
Yes.
Where he seemed to suggest, and then he did that later in the actual one where they go like Mars and Venus.
Yeah,
and
the Perelander trilogy.
Yeah, where like for every civilization there will be a Jesus. And I thought, okay, that's pretty, I mean, that's very ecumenical of you, sir, but I don't know that that's exactly how that would work out.
Yeah, and I think that the Perelander trilogy is like, it's kind of allegorical, because I mean, especially the second one when he goes to Venus and it's like, you know, the apple is, you right. know, in this case, it's about spending a night on, you know, solid land instead of one of these floating mats of vegetation. And it's so it's like sort of setting up a new form of the temptation of Eve, and really, really very clearly. But
Is it an allegory or is it just a retelling?
Yeah, I guess
is there a difference?
Yeah, and I mean it's so clearly like, I mean, it's basically like, psst, Dr. Ransom.
Right.
Hint, hint. Here is the temptation of Eve happening all over again. Could you please go prevent that so that it doesn't happen the way that it did on Earth, which basically messed everything up? Like, it's very clearly, you know, the allegory is spelled out letter by letter, whereas in Narnia, I had to know some things about, you know, religion in yeah. order to see that.
Oddly enough, I wasn't really introduced to C.S. Lewis. However, I did manage to get a copy of one of his when they exist at the same time and they know each other. I don't know. Contemporaries. That's
yes,
the word
that
I'm looking
one.
For. Olaf Stapledon, which is probably one of my favorite early science fiction novels, which is Last and First Men, which is almost not a story. It's just really just sort of a historical narrative of roughly 75 billion years of human existence.
Ooh.
And, we die fairly early on. I mean, literally, it's like the first fourth of the book. And, but what I liked about it is that C.S. Lewis wrote, on the copy I had, C.S. Lewis said, this is how I feel about Olaf Stapledon. He's great. He's an imaginative. He's a really great person to talk to, but we disagree on pretty much everything with a little bit of tint of he might be going to hell and added, but
yeah.
All right. So let's move on to some other stuff. Same nation, different story. Some people think of Middle Earth as a Christian sort of allegory.
Yeah. And speaking of, I once heard, and I haven't had this verified, that Tolkien had not set out to write a religious allegory. But I mean, you have the king returning, Gandalf resurrects.
Yeah.
Like, there is so much like redemption and it just coming back from the dead. Like, it is the most Christian, non-Christian like story ever. And the fellowship, because it was the Christian fellowship that I was a part of in college.
Sure. Yeah.
While these movies were coming out, basically claimed it
mm-hmm.
as a religious story.
Well, Tolkien was religious.
He was.
Right.
Was he trying to tell this as a...
Well, I have it on good authority. And by good authority, I mean somebody who does Tolkien stuff for a living.
Okay, that's good.
And specifically from a literary perspective, that Tolkien was after basically an English myth.
Yes.
He was trying to build some sort of myth with a little bit of mythology behind it for the purposes, you know, for the place where he lived. And I would find it very difficult for somebody to write a myth of a very Christian place without including some small amount of Christian allegory in it. And so, I mean, unlike the Perelander series, it's not written out entirely in stone. Things don't play out exactly like they do in the Bible, but there are some literary themes which may have influenced Middle Earth, if not you know, rather than just completely stole.
Yeah. At sunrise on the third day, look to the east.
Yeah, that kind of stuff. I mean, I'm not going to make this about Dune, but there is certainly Christ allegory in Dune. I mean, you know, Paul is Jesus, full stop, yeah. Moving on. And then there's movies where, then there's like, thing that I wanted to talk about was Cool Hand Luke. It's one of my dad's favorite movies. He passed it on to me.
I've literally never seen this.
Okay, we need to watch this, I think, if we're going to talk about it. But there is sort of the post-scourging flop-down moment where his arms are splayed out, where it's very clearly that Luke is a allegorical figure in this. And it actually takes it a little bit away from the narrative for me when they start playing it really that obvious. It's just like, okay, come on, I get what you're going for here. You didn't have to do that.
I think that also got really heavy in, forgive me for even mentioning,
I was gonna wonder, yeah.
The third Matrix. Even in the first one, like it was there, you know, the chosen one, and again there's this resurrection thing, but then I think it was the end of the third movie where this, like, let me sacrifice myself for all humans, and then I'm going to flop here in this sort of crucifixion pose.
Right.
Yeah, a little bit obvious.
I was really let down by the Matrix movies because I saw the first one and I thought it was going to be like a Ramayana allegory or something Vedic, suitably Vedic, because it looked like it was going to have some Hindu mythology in it, and it was going to have stuff that you wouldn't normally see in a religiously themed science fiction movie in the Western world. And then the second movie, I was done with it very early in the second movie when it became clear that, nope, this is Jesus. Jesus, 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 everywhere Jesus.
I don't think that liking the first one and being disappointed in the second two Matrix movies is a controversial opinion. You probably just have a different, like, impetus.
Well, it
for
was
that.
Bad science fiction all the way through. I mean, I watched the first movie in 99, I watched it, and I'm like, oh, this is really boring. And then somebody who did movies was like, no, go back and watch the cinematography, notice the subtle effects, not the obvious ones, and then you may enjoy it a little bit. And he was exactly right. It was the second watching of it where I was paying attention to not the science fiction, because I am such a science fiction nerd, actually opened up that this was actually a very well put together movie and the characterization was meaningful. It's just that the MacGuffin that makes the story go is kind of a joke.
Yeah, I really appreciated it as something that I could relate to that would get across the Plato's allegory of the cave.
Right.
Because when I first encountered that in like my 11th grade philosophy class, I'm like, but why are they, like, if they're stuck in the cave and they can't move their heads, but they can still like feel their bodies and perceive themselves as like people, right? Like, how do they not realize that they're stuck in a cave? And like, I got so caught up in the logistics that I couldn't even get to this idea of when you perceive something that is not in fact reality, but if it's, you know, all that you know, you will see it as reality. And then suddenly the Matrix comes out and it's like, oh, brain plugged into a computer, that I can relate to.
Being in a cave, no, that's totally alien.
Nope.
Brain plugged into a computer. You know, everybody would think that would be my problem with it. Not because you head off to the wilderness quite often.
I do actually head off to the wilderness quite often.
I'm the guy who's constantly surrounded by technology. Yeah. And, well, whatever. So let's move on to the second category we'll talk a little bit about, and that's the conversion story.
Oh my gosh.
I actually do not have... unless Left Behind counts, I don't have a lot of conversion fiction here, for a reason I'll get to in a minute. But you apparently have quite a bit in your library.
I do, and I need to get rid of it somehow, but it's like, book burning makes you a Nazi. I don't want to leave it in a little free library because then someone else has to read it. Like,
right.
I don't know how to get rid of some of this stuff. Would you like it for your collection?
I suppose so, yeah.
Yeah. I would say The Screwtape Letters is
okay.
One.
Well, that's, I mean, now we're back to C.S. Lewis, aren't we?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
He did it all, man.
All right, talk a bit about those.
So The Screwtape Letters is basically this you know, story, but it's told in a series of letters, and I think there's a word, epistop, I can't remember the word right now.
Yeah.
A series of letters between Screwtape...
A series of epistles.
There we go.
Yes.
Epistolary? I think that's the word I'm looking for. Between Screwtape, who is some sort of demonic bureaucrat, and his, I think, nephew, Wormtongue, Wormwood. It's been a minute since I read this. And they're basically talking about how to best tempt the soul of this poor mortal and, you know, how to draw him away from these religious influences in his life and how, you have to sort of like sedate him and get him bored and, you know, make his life happy and easy, because it's in these times of, you know, terrible stress and trouble that people turn to God. And at the end,
right,
they eventually fail and Wormtongue will be destroyed for his terrible work ethic.
Because being bad at his job.
That's how apparently demonic bureaucracies work.
Right.
You screw it up and then you are destroyed.
Yeah, I thought there was like a fixed number of these guys because of the fall. Like, it's not like the factory is still open.
You know, and my favorite, sorry, least favorite thing about sort of this type of conversion story where you actually do see the demonic sides of things is it's like the characterization of evil, it's always a bureaucracy for some reason.
Well, yeah.
And I don't know if that's supposed to be some sort of social commentary, but it's like really boring.
I think we'd have to go into historical fiction to look for an alternative, because in you know, bureaucracy in the West came with industrialization, and most of the stuff that we're talking about was written post-industrialization. So
yeah,
and bureaucracy is about as close to anything that I'll call evil. So
yeah, so I guess aside from that, you'd have to go check out either the Commedia, Divine Comedy, or Paradise Lost.
Right, which are two stories that we thought we wouldn't touch on specifically,
yeah,
because, I mean, when you get before a certain age, kind of all books in the West were religious.
Yeah.
And you got to be careful with that. And
yeah,
you can't just say, oh, it was all terrible. I mean, well, I kind of like the Divine Comedy. Anyway,
yeah,
moving on. What other stories? So the Screwtape letters, there's got to be somebody not C.S. Lewis can give us some parallels.
Yes.
Here.
Frank Peretti.
Frank Peretti. That's the name I don't know.
Okay. He wrote This Present Darkness and Piercing the Darkness. And this is the other one that has that demonic bureaucracy in it. So This Present Darkness, it was published in like the late 1980s, I believe.
Right.
And it's basically, oh my gosh, I cannot even talk about this with a straight face. So the plot is basically there is demonic influence on this small town, and basically, if you go to college and learn how to meditate, you open yourself up to demonic possession. But the small town preacher, through the power of prayer, can cast out all these demons and save everyone.
Actual casting out of demons?
Is, yes.
Okay. All
yeah,
right.
And I mean, it's not like exorcism. It's not that kind of casting out of demons, but it's more along the lines of, I don't know, kind of spiritual like pest control or something. Like you pray hard enough and long enough and eventually the demons lose influence and then they go off to be destroyed because they're bad at their jobs.
The University Unitarian Humanists, Seattle Atheists, and the Humanists of Washington cordially invite freethinkers, their families, and friends from Seattle and beyond to celebrate the coming winter solstice with our annual solstice potluck on Saturday, December 10th from 5 to 8 p.m. at the University Unitarian Church in Seattle. This year, we are encouraging attendees to bring new socks to donate to Treehouse, an organization benefiting foster youth in the greater Seattle area. Children are a welcome and essential part of this celebration. For more information, visit humanistsofwashington.org or seattleatheists.org.
The Humanists of Washington is the oldest humanist organization in the state and offers a community of freethinkers who educate the public and celebrate life. Come celebrate life with us. Humanists support intellectual freedom and critical thinking and hold that human beings are autonomous centers of moral development. You can become a member of the Humanists of Washington at humanistsofwashington.org. You'll get our quarterly publication, The Secular Humanist Press. Check out meetup.com where you can be part of our monthly Seattle dinner and our Heathens Do It Better breakfast. Humanists of Washington.
Allegedly, soccer is a beautiful game.
It is when you know what's going on.
That's the problem. MLS is 20 years old, and people are still shocked to hear that there's an American Soccer League.
That's why you and I are talking about it. This is a discussion of American soccer for nerds and beginners. It's a good first step if a crippling soccer addiction is something that's missing from your life.
Join the club. Celebrate the 20th anniversary of MLS by actually following the season.
Hands-free football. New episodes every week at handsfreefootball.com. Bring it back, but it's
more than basic. My name is Jonathan Ariola of TDTF Pod. The more voices you hear, the more we observe and feel, the more we learn about the other facets of this complex and wondrous beast that is humanism and free thought. Join me on the science-loving journey through topics like justice, murder, family, diligence, taste, history, society, race, boob jobs, law, addiction, video games, fear, sacrifice, children. Wait, not sacrificing children. That's not what I meant. Bring the popcorn and watch me break down the issues too deep, too fast. Join me at TDTF Pod. I'm Jonathan Ariola. Talk to you soon.
Well, there's a reason I don't have a lot of... Well, actually, that's not true. One of the things that I find most interesting about the conversion story is I do find it the most lurid of what I call pornography in this case.
Yes.
So I guess we need to talk about what I mean by pornography. Is the concept behind pornography is that something that should be private and between two individuals, or perhaps even one individual, where there's a lot of personal joy or meaning behind it, is brought up in lurid context for the
satisfaction of others.
For the satisfaction of the voyeuristic satisfaction of others.
Yes.
And I find that I kind of like propaganda for that in some respects, because it lets you see when somebody writes a piece of propaganda, there it's very difficult for them to stick just to the matter at hand when they do this art, that the other parts have to come into it. And that inadvertent telling, that inadvertent information that's being let loose with propaganda is honestly more interesting to me than what the propaganda is nominally about, because it says something about the author and it gives you a deeper context if you can learn to look for it. Now, granted, not every piece of propaganda has it, but the larger and more complex the work, the more likely this is.
Yes.
And conversion stories are basically the most lurid of it. It's the worst pornography.
I have hated all forms of conversion stories, no matter what era of my life I have been in.
Right.
I hate it in fiction. You have chick tracks downstairs on your like bar thing,
and that's all they are. Yeah, they always end up with somebody with oddly enough, their rear end stuck up in the air with their head bowed over and going, "Oh my God, Jesus, oh Jesus." And
that's not weird.
It's not weird. That's totally weird. And I happen to have a lot. I guess if you count chick tracks, then I have a lot of conversion porn in my collection.
Yeah,
but not much outside of Jack Chick.
I don't even like listening to people's own personal conversion stories. And I know there's entire like radio shows or podcasts or whatever out there about that.
Well, there's certainly a version of that here in the atheism community, which is the deconversion story.
Yeah. And it's just all of that. I sort of, you know, it's so private. Like if someone wants to share it with me, like I'll sit there and listen uncomfortably, but it's like,
well,
I don't know.
Well, it's, I mean, you did kind of give a little bit of your story at the beginning of the segment.
I did, but yeah. Sort of the gritty, gooey details.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't get on religious people for posting their conversion stories because it's important to them, and they're among their people who, you know, they feel most important or most connected to, and they want to talk about themselves, and I get that. It's one thing when it's your conversion story, but it's another thing entirely when you're constructing this conversion story for the purposes of titillation.
Yeah.
Which is nobody describes it that way. But when you talk about, it's not like non-Christians are reading a lot of these conversion stories. And it's not like, and they say that they, in a lot of these books, and the Left Behind novels are a very good example of that, which we'll get to in a minute, where they say that they're writing these things for the purposes of non-Christians to see what Christians look like when they convert, or when the process of what people becoming Christians looks like. Except there are so many tells to their specific type of Christianity, or so many stuff that's there that you only find about in the terms of sermons, and that don't make any sense to in a context where somebody doesn't already know about those things, that it's very obvious that it's written with a particular audience who's already Christian in mind.
Yeah, and I think for me, and this is more from a narrative point of view, like, whichever target this is who will be converted by the end of the story has to have something going on with their life to show that they do need to be redeemed.
Yeah.
But you can't have it be so bad that you don't feel weird about having them in the club after the fact. So this Present Darkness, the Frank Peretti novel I mentioned, it seriously is going to college and learning how to meditate.
Oh, wow.
Like taking a yoga class.
Okay.
Which opens you up to demonic influence, apparently. Like, that is the sin that is being committed wherein people then need to be saved. And so it's like, you know, that's not an issue.
Right.
Ever. Like, no one looks at someone taking yoga class and says, like, oh my gosh, your life is so messed up. Let me read this book to figure out. You know, it's just, it always felt really fake. And I can't deal with it.
And that brings us to our, the last major category we're going to touch on a little bit. Which is apocalyptic Christian fiction.
Oh my gosh.
And I think it's worth, I think we got to talk about the elephant in the room here, which is Left Behind, because Tim LaHaye, one of the founders of one of the worst social movements America has ever seen, and one of the authors of the Left Behind novels, died this year. And, I've read through Glorious Appearing. So I've read 12 of the novels. How far did you get?
I have no idea, actually. I picked these books up in college at the recommendation of a friend and devoured them because it was like, I don't know, interesting and very Christian and good reading for, you know, someone who was new into it. But I cannot remember what was going on. I do think I remember feeling like, yes, it's good. I found like this, you know, Christian story, but I think that I remember also thinking that it was kind of clunkily written, and I was always a little bit ashamed of Christian fiction, and it's just more of that same because there's so much message, there is a distinct lack of skill.
So when I was a kid, and my dad was the super at a apartment complex that we lived in, which happened somewhat frequently. The husband of the leasing manager died, and he was apparently. And one of the things that she would say is that my dad and her husband had in common is that they were both very avid readers. Because my dad, there were always novels around the house, always. Sometimes very good ones, sometimes exceedingly bad ones. My dad did not care. He would read all of them. He was a very avid reader. When this guy died, we received a large influx of new books, which all turned out to be Mac Bolan novels. And I don't know if you know what Mac Bolan is.
I don't, actually.
It's basically the Hardy Boys for the more masculine explosion gun set. It's a serialized novel. It's like, the Remo Williams novels. It's like, the movie that Arnold Schwarzenegger was in, the Conan movie, novels. It's written by multiple authors, written, about one character, tend to be kind of formulaic in their function. And
yes,
we received a pile of novels that were of the most formulaic era of the Mac Bolan novels. I now know, because I know somebody who's a author and aficionado of these things. And basically they all had stories like explosion in Pittsburgh or, terror in Texas or, enormity in Edinburgh or something like that. And it was always like, the cover always had a bad thing in a location with Mac Bolan, some weapon of some stripe. It was usually a different weapon, and some trophy woman somewhere in the foreground. And you could literally read all the way up to a certain page. Like, you read to 283 on one book, and you're done reading it because you're done in the bathroom. And you put it on the shelf. And when you go back to continue reading, you can pick a completely different book, turn to page 284, and you won't have missed a beat.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. These were not good novels. It's like, yes, I made it clear we were reading these in the bathroom, but that's not necessarily was a bad thing in my family. My bathrooms have bookshelves.
Yeah.
The Left Behind novels were a lot like that for me. Except they weren't so formulaic, because they definitely had a consistent narrative that changed as time went on, because things would always get worse, and, you know, it's supposed to end with Jesus coming back and nuking everybody, in a literal Deus Ex Machina. But, you could basically pick up the novel at any point and kind of figure out what was going on in terms of five pages, because not much happens in a lot of these novels. They were supposed to be a trilogy, apparently.
Oh my gosh.
And they got stretched to, what, 14, 15 novels now?
Something like that.
Yeah. So what was your experience reading them like?
I read them, and it was interesting because, like I said, this was at a period in my life where I was learning about Christianity the first time. And so it was sort of fun to like read through it and then reread the Book of Revelations and sort of see like where are they getting all these influences for this story that's happening. And so I enjoyed that puzzle of it. But in retrospect, it's just... One of the things that bothered me about Christianity when I sort of joined in was it's like this club where everyone believes the same thing, and so we should all get along like insta-family, you
right,
know?
Right, right.
And that, I think, plays out in Christian fiction very frequently. And that was one of the things that kind of bothered me about this book, is it sort of felt like, okay, let's take a 4 or 5 page break here to preach to someone, and then they're going to come join the family. And now instantly we are on the same side and have the same agenda and magical technology. And just like, Jesus is not the only Deus Ex Machina in this book.
Like, no. No, sometimes it's a host of angels. Sometimes it's just, sometimes it's not explained. Like, they don't even give the suggestion that there was some sort of magical thing that happened. It's just things happen. They're not explained. You're just expected to accept them as not magical. Because it's not because they're trying to say that God is in all things. It's because they can't write a freaking narrative, and they have to have these absences of narrative in order to connect the dots.
Yes.
And that's a problem. And another thing goes back to something I learned in creative writing, which is the best thing ever. Never write the best thing ever in your books unless you really are the best thing at the thing that you're doing. And for example, Cameron Buck Williams, one of the major characters of these novels, is supposed to be the greatest investigative reporter of all time.
Oh my gosh, I forgot about him.
Yeah. He dies. And anyway, so what happens is he's the greatest investigative reporter of all time. The authors are not. And so when they actually have to sit down and show him be the greatest investigative reporter of all time, you have to make it look like he really is. And if you're not that good of a writer, it's going to stink, and it's going to be terrible, and it's going to completely take people out of your narrative. And that's precisely what happens in the Left Behind novels, which is why if you're going to have the best at anything, you need to have it be something that can't really be conveyed in a literary sense, like the best sculptor or the best painter or something like that. Set of novels that I actually quite like almost gets close to this problem where in the Hyperion novels with Martin Solanas, which is he's the best poet.
Oh.
And there's a lot of poetry in the Hyperion novels, but he's kind of an ex-poet by that point. And so it still works.
Yes.
And so this is a lesson I got in my creative class, and this leads me into another recommendation I have for every time I bring up the Left Behind novels, which is if you want to see why the Left Behind novels are bad in both a literary and theological sense, I cannot recommend Fred Clark's blog, The Slacktivist, to people enough. It's on what is the name? Pathios. It's on Pathios. He didn't start there, but he's on Pathios now, and all of his Left Behind posts were there. And he was going page by page through the first, like, three books of the Left Behind novels, explaining why everything stinks.
I love that sort of thing.
Only from a literary standpoint, because the guy did a lot of, you know, he is also a journalist. And, but also because he's a Baptist pastor, but not like any Baptist I've ever met in my life. I'll just put it that way. And, so he talks about it in terms of theology, and it's definitely worth reading. And I recommend it to people who want to make fun of Left Behind because it really tells you a lot. But I also recommend it to people who say that there's no case for Christians. There's no case for them to be good people, et cetera, et cetera. I always recommend this guy because he's great.
Okay.
Yeah. And he goes into the greatest thing of all time in his blog. And it's like, and he finally got to that. He got to that while I was reading, because I actually read his blog after I read the first four books. So it was kind of a review for me by that point. It was like, yes, I remember this. Yeah, exactly, exactly, exactly. It was pretty great.
Yeah.
So there was one more thing, but we didn't have a lot of research for it, and that was the slice of life Christian stuff.
This is honestly something I wish there was more of, because I've read this, and I think I could read it now. Oh my God, I just remembered. Sorry. Research done.
Okay.
So what I had in mind when I brought this up is a novel called Flabbergasted by Ray Blackston. And it's basically, this is a normal story. It's about this guy who sort of changes jobs and moves cities and then is looking for a lady friend, and so has to make some decisions about this one who, like, you know, is sort of nearby and it could be good, but then there's Dream Girl who's off in, like, some weird, you know, job in the jungle. And, you know, it's a story. It's like this, you know, crappy little romance novel that you read on the beach or the airplane, with the exception of everyone in there is a Christian, and right. They all attend the same church. And so occasionally they pray for each other because they've got some hard decisions. And, you know, the protagonist is asking himself, like, what does God want me to do in this situation? But there's no, like, preaching. It's more like good life advice if you are going to live out some not crazy Christian principles, like, you know, trust, you know, God's whatever.
No, go ahead. Yeah.
Trust God's plan, or don't act out of fear, or like some of those other things. Don't take the easy way out. Treat people with respect.
Sort of a slice of life morality play then?
Yeah, kind of. All and right. It's like, it's not awful.
Right.
And I just really enjoy it still. Like, this is one that's probably going to remain on my bookshelf even after I'm, like, you know, cleared off the 12 Bibles that I still have on there.
So this is the genre where most of my collection isn't in the form of a book, but is in the form of a video or music or something like that. But two examples I can come up with are Family Circus, I think might qualify as this, and Family Circus, I don't know that it's stultifying because it's a Christian slice of life thing, but it's pretty stultifying. But also, last week from my perspective, but a few months ago at this point, I talked to my cousin Charlie Mulvey, and one of the things that he brought up is Willow Creek Church, which is one of the first mega churches in the United States, was basically in our backyard. And it was. And I saw a play there that was a Christian musical slice of life drama. My grandmother bought me, because she got tickets from a friend of hers. I don't know that she knew what it was we were going to. And I wanted to drill my ear out by the end of it. One, because it was like a group of people I'd never seen in my life before. Two, because it was a musical and I was really anti-musical at the time, because I was a kid. I don't know a lot of kids who are really into musicals like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. But brings to one of my favorite things in my collection, which was the Estes Perkel movies. Estes Perkel has one movie, which is, I've got two. I've watched one all the way through. I can't make it through the other. One of them is, the one I have watched is If the Footmen Tire You, What Will the Horses Do? Which is the Russians and the Cubans invade southern United States.
Okay.
And it's a bunch of people in the South doing this movie where they're playing both the victims and the people invading. So they're trying to do Cuban Russian accents with thick Southern accents, and it's really messy. And it end and actually one of there might be a song you may be familiar with. It's a Negative Land song, and it's communism is good, Christianity is stupid, Christianity is stupid, free candy. It's all from this movie.
It sounds like low budget Red Dawn.
It's really low budget Red Dawn, except nobody wins.
I mean, did anyone win in Red Dawn?
Fair point. Okay, yeah. but then they jam a stick into this kid's ear all the way through, and he's just sitting there with his stick. But it's not that good, so it doesn't squick you out or anything like that. He's just sitting there with a stick through his ears, and then he throws up. But it's clearly some dude ADRing the throw up in. So it's really, you should watch it. We should watch it.
Apparently.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then he did another one, which is a nicer one, which is way more boring. But they are sub drive-in theater quality. So I got one more thing here before
Because I remembered, this is the epiphany, one more slice of life that I don't hate.
Okay.
This one's like slightly more evangelical. It's the At Home in Mitford series by, I'm going to mispronounce this, but I'm guessing Jan Karen. It's spelled with a J.
Okay.
So it might be Jan Karen.
It's usually Jan.
Okay.
Yeah.
And this is, I like it because, I mean, it's very heavily religious. The main character, the protagonist, is a small town, like, reverend, vicar, pastor. I don't freaking know.
Yeah.
But what I love about it is the small towniness of it. Like, it's just this cute little community. And, you know, again, sometimes they pray for each other and people need help making the right decisions. And that family feeling that I wanted when I first started drinking the Kool-Aid, like, this book shows it off pretty well.
Okay.
It's just a cute little sort of small town, everyone up in each other's business kind of thing.
So it's a slice of life, it's slice of life Christian fiction that is actually good.
Yeah.
Okay.
And yeah, I would say that, I mean, there is some conversion part in it, but it's not nearly as lurid because it's not like this 4-page, like, out in the middle of nothing. It's like you actually get to know people and see their motivations. It feels less like pornography and more like a romance novel.
Okay. All right. No, you don't have to justify liking something. There's a lot of stuff. If it's good, it's good. I think quality can transcend those kind of barriers.
Yeah. This is better than a lot of what we've talked about today.
Lack of quality certainly. If lack of quality can transcend these barriers,
yes,
quality should be able to as
all
well.
All right, then.
The University Unitarian Humanists, Seattle Atheists, and the Humanists of Washington cordially invite freethinkers, their families, and friends from Seattle and beyond to celebrate the coming winter solstice with our annual solstice potluck on Saturday, December 10th from 5 to 8 p.m. at the University Unitarian Church in Seattle. This year, we are encouraging attendees to bring new socks to donate to Treehouse, an organization benefiting foster youth in the greater Seattle area. Children are a welcome and essential part of this celebration. For more information, visit humanistsofwashington.org or seattleatheists.org.
48 hours. 24 hours. 10 minutes to go.
The motorcade appears to have stopped, and yes, it appears as though the governor is getting out now. It's hard to see. My God, the rain it's coming down in sheets. I've never seen anything like this. There must be tens of thousands of people out here right now. The streets are shut down. Okay, it appears the governor is making his way toward the convention center. No one knows what he's going to say. The crowd is pushing forward through the storm. The Secret Service is struggling to hold them back. A wave of people are rushing toward the candidate. My God.
Zero. For your consideration, we present Convention and its subject, the nominee, ANNEX Radio.com. Now on iTunes and Stitcher.
I'm Mike Gillis.
And I'm Casey Dorn. And we want to ask you an important question.
Are you sick and tired of other panel discussion shows wasting your time droning on and on about foreign policy, economics, and human rights?
Or do you want to hear conversations about things that actually matter?
We host a podcast called Radio Versus the Martians. Every month we gather a panel of our nation's finest minds and plunge a rusty prison shank into the heart of tough questions that have an impact on the lives of real people like you.
Like, are drivers required to pull over for the Ghostbusters?
Is the United Federation of Planets actually an oppressive dictatorship run by guidance counselors?
Is Arnold Schwarzenegger secretly a genius?
And are we being mean when we laugh at movies that are so bad they're good?
So write your congressman and let them know that Radio Versus the Martians is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and on RadioVersusTheMartians.com.
Has Ngadwe Trust invaded your town? Are you tired of government officials who want to plaster "In God We Trust" on taxpayer-owned property? Are you afraid because your local sheriff placed an "In God We Trust" decal on the patrol cars? We are here to help. The original motto project is for those who feel the separation of church and state is an important issue and should be honored regardless of your belief or lack thereof. Theists, non-theists, and all free thinkers are welcome. We need your support to show politicians that diversity exists within our nation, and their promotion of a monotheistic religion and push for theocracy will not be tolerated. Stand up and be heard. Join us at originalmotto.us.
And that actually goes directly into something I want to end the show on. But first, I have this phrase that I would really like you to explain to me right here. If Stephen King were a member of Slipknot, Ted Dekker.
Oh my gosh. So when we were preparing for this episode, I wanted Ted Dekker to be the last category that we talked about.
And here we are.
Ted Dekker, for me, it's not so much if he was a member of Slipknot, but he's if Stephen King and Dean Koontz had a baby and then that baby went off to church camp.
Okay.
And that's Ted Dekker. And he sort of does Christian horror / thriller.
Okay.
And the reason he's my absolute favorite hate read, even above Left Behind, is there's this novel called Three. And I'm going to start with the movie adaptation.
Okay.
So in the movie adaptation, the twin brother is telling about some screenplay or something he's working on where the serial killer and the next victim and the cop are all actually the same person. And it's supposed to be this completely off the wall, just utter nonsense, ridiculous suggestion. And then after that movie came out, and I'm not saying because that movie came out, but definitely after that movie came out, Ted Dekker published this novel called Three, where there is some sort of stalker / serial killer and his next victim and the cop pursuing, who are all, in fact, because of multiple personalities, the same person. And so I just imagine Ted Dekker sitting there watching adaptation and going like, oh, yeah, I got it. Because it's like the Trinity. Yeah. And what I hate about Ted Dekker is that it's really poorly written concepts like that. But what I liked about it is the Present Darkness stuff, you know, the sins are going to college and learning how to meditate.
We talked about that earlier.
Yeah. And with Ted Dekker, there's car crashes and people get shot, and it's just there's a lot more actual action. And if you want something that you're gonna read on a beach or on an airplane, it's Dean Koontz with an overlay of Jesus.
Okay. I always thought, and this brings us into perhaps a side conversation we should have some other day, which is, Christian versions of popular things. And because I noticed that three is spelled three.
It's actually got the numeral shoved
in. Yeah, where it immediately reminded me of Sissa 7 and the also, and then you told me a little bit of the plot, and it's a literally nebulous killer. And I'm like, is this the Christian version of 7? And you were like, no, wait.
Yes.
Like, all right. And so that's what it looked like to me. And I may have to give this a read. I didn't know about this guy, but he sounds fantastic.
Yeah. And there's a lot. And there's like several multi-book series that he's got going on.
Yeah.
And I'm sure every single one of them is just a treat.
All right. So, I'm really enjoying this conversation because I don't get to talk about I allude to the fact that I have this amazing collection of weird religious stuff right here, but I don't talk about it very much. And I don't talk about just the sheer amount of it that I have read versus the stuff I just have just for the collection. Like, I've never actually sat down and read a Gish book, for example, because I don't really want a Gish gallop all over my brain. But there's a lot of the fiction, and I've actually read it. And it's fun to talk about it. However, I asked you to do a thing for us here on Ask an Atheist, and maybe this is the start of the Sam and Carol Evil Book Club something like that. But I wanted you to recommend a good Christian evangelical piece of literature and a bad Christian evangelical piece of literature. I'm gonna do not what Mike does, and I want to start with the good one because
okay.
We've been spending most of our time talking about stuff that stinks. So let's talk about something good for a few minutes.
Yeah. So the one I want to recommend is The Sparrow by Mary Doria Russell.
Okay.
And I realized after I decided that this was going to be my recommendation, I had a conversation with Dave, who has also read this book and also really enjoyed it. And he said, that one actually might be anti-Christian in nature. And it's hard to tell, but it's just really, really a good story. The premise is that we find evidence of life elsewhere in the universe, sort of within distance. If you sort of hop on a spaceship and go to sleep for a couple of decades, you know, one of those. And so while all of the countries of the world are sort of bickering, trying to get their space program together, the Jesuits get it sorted and send missionaries.
Okay.
And the idea is that everyone on this ship is really good people, really smart people. They've studied history. They know the danger of first contact with another civilization, but they're going to try and get it right this time. And it doesn't...
Okay.
So, and it's just, it's really beautiful and tragic, and there's good religious themes. And
do you know other Christians who've read this book in a Christian context, or?
I do. This was actually passed around during college.
Okay.
And the Christians really liked it because it's got sort of this, I mean, it's a mission trip.
Right.
Basically.
Yeah.
And it talks about the importance of like really getting to know the people that you're going to go preach to, et cetera, et cetera. But then I guess I've met a lot of non-Christians. I've met atheists who really like it because like it talks about how, no matter how good your intentions are, like sometimes it's just going to get messed up. There's a line that Dave really likes that I could share now.
Maybe I've got some ideas here, so maybe not now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Then no. But it's just a really good book. And the funny thing about it is I've read it once. I will probably not read it again because it's...
A little depressing?
It's very depressing and it's powerful enough. I don't need to. And I just don't know that I can take it again. Like,
okay.
It's really good and everyone should read it once.
Hmm. Yeah. Now that does kind of undo my plan a little bit.
Uh-oh.
All right. So let's get to the bad fiction.
Oh my gosh. This one is a true throw up. Like, what do you need in a good hate read? And I thought it was going to be Ted Dekker. I thought it was going to be three. But when I was driving home from our last meeting and I remembered Frank Peretti, This Present Darkness, like it was like a flash to a recovered memory. It was almost traumatic. Like, it's because it's not just like bad theology. It's not just poorly written. It's got that demonic bureaucracy thing that I hate. It's also got like some terrible grammar. Like, it's just on all levels, it is really bad.
Okay.
So,
but we talked about it already, so I'm kind of glad we ended on that. I was actually wondering if we could read this and then perhaps talk about it on a Patreon podcast.
Yeah, I can do that.
Because, like I said, we both really like fiction, and I owe you a few books still. I'm in the middle of reading one right now. But I actually kind of like this idea of going through it.
Okay.
This is the kind of stuff that I do. And the idea of, okay, you know, I love really bad things. I do. But the idea of reading a good example of something and a bad example of something, I think, was just to give you a lay of the land, I think, is an interesting idea. But, I think that ends this conversation.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Carol. And if people would like to hear you talk about perhaps not this, perhaps about the Sounders and the MLS.
Oh my God, it's not, okay.
Laser.
Anyway.
Laser.
It's not
laser.
The MLS.
Yes, it is.
I get to be pedantic about this. Yes, you can find me. We're on iTunes, but also all the episodes can be found on handsfreefootball.com. And if you listen to episode 0, Sam talks about baseball for like 40 minutes.
Is it literally 40 minutes?
I don't know. It feels like a long time.
There is an episode where I talk about the game we just went to.
Yeah.
And where I inadvertently call most of my friends fascists.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the end of this podcast. You can go to our website at askanatheist.tv. Email us at questions@askanatheist.tv. You can voicemail us at 844-753-7842. That's 844-SKEPTIC. You can visit us on Twitter on askanatheistwa. This episode was pre-recorded. Thank you guys very much. See you next week.